first, the customer is always right, right? That's a common slogan in the retail industry and other service jobs. But in the real world, of course, the customer is often wrong. And the pandemic has highlighted that with lots of anecdotes about abusive behavior by customers of airlines, restaurants, stores, and more. Our next guest says there are problems built into the modern service industry from its very beginning that can make life difficult for employees. And it's created a situation where added stress from the pandemic has resulted in customers becoming disruptive and sometimes violent. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you now or have you ever worked in a service industry? What types of experiences have you had with customers during the pandemic? Good, bad, otherwise? Are you a customer who's had a tense situation in a store or on a plane? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she has a column on consumerism called Material World. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
In a recent piece, Amanda, you dig into the history of the service sector. We'll get into that in just a bit, but are we really seeing a rise in abusive customer behavior during the pandemic in places like airlines and elsewhere?
Yes. There are only certain types of interactions that are tracked. But if we use the airline industry as sort of a microcosm of the service industry at large, what you see there is a real marked increase in things that rise to the level of a crime, which means those are incidents that get reported to the FAA, where they keep all the numbers in track. And we have had more violent passengers during the pandemic than in ever before in recorded FAA history. It's been a real increase in people who become unruly, who attack flight attendants, who attack other passengers, who have to be restrained, sometimes it requires flight attendants to enlist other passengers to restrain them or subdue them. There have been situations in which flights have had to be diverted and landed early. So if you see that happening there in a place where everybody knows there's a lot of rules, there's really high stakes for acting out, there are lots of behaviors that you know that you can't do on an airplane, that sort of gives you an idea of what people are doing in places where there aren't as many rules, where behavior is a little bit more, tolerated. And then you see situations in which people in grocery stores, people at the mall, there's been a lot of viral videos showing consumers getting in fights, attacking workers. There have been situations in which people have been killed, have been murdered over mask mandates, over slow service, things like that. So there's lots and lots of evidence that this has become a much worse problem in the past year and a half.
And you write that the pandemic is making things worse, but the pandemic isn't the fundamental problem here. You say that we've been trained in some ways through a century or so of service sector work, or more than that, to have these expectations of what happens when we walk into the store or the airline or whatever. How did that training evolve?
Yes. Well, when I set out to write this story, I didn't know the answer to this question. I just knew that I have worked in service jobs, and you see, even before the pandemic, you see an incredible level of abuse if you work in the service industry. So I set about looking to see where customer service and this idea of American customer service in particular started. And it's traced to a period of time, the Gilded Age, between 1870 and 1920, in which department stores became a really, really popular part of American life and sort of changed how Americans got stuff. Before 1870 or so, people really didn't shop in the way that we think of it now. There were dry goods stores and general stores and things like that, but people grew a lot of what they used. They made their clothes. They did carpentry for themselves. People were a lot more self-sustaining. So you get the Industrial Revolution and you get like a real increase in the number of goods available for people. And by that token, you need a place to sell them. So these sort of giant community-centered stores were opened by department store, by these sort of like retail barons is what they became, as sort of a counterpart to industrial production.
Let's visit one of those stores now, Amanda. Here's a clip from a 1939 film called The Women, set here at a closing time at a department store. Here's a listen.
I'm afraid we're keeping you.
Oh, that's quite all right.
Well, I'll take this. Charge it and send. Here's my name and address.
25 cents. My, you are getting off economically, aren't you?
Aren't I?
It'll be out tomorrow, Mrs. Prowler.
Fowler.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Mrs. Fowler.
I'm the impertinent little upstart. If she thinks I'm going to let her get away with that, she's got another thing.
Come on, you weren't exactly any little Pollyanna yourself. It's no wonder she called
that Prowler, really. She's laughing at us. I know, I can see from here.
Well, I believe she is.
She called me that deliberately. I'll have her fired. I'll go straight to the management this minute.
Yes, let me talk to the manager, Amanda. So you write that I never thought of it this way. These department stores were catering to middle-class customers, people who might not be rich enough to have servants, but here's a department store where maybe they get to treat someone like their servants for a little while.
Yes. What department stores did, the biggest trick they pulled was creating sort of a middle class identity where there hadn't really been one before. Before, it was people who worked and people who owned things, basically. And when you get to the Industrial Revolution, you get a lot of like advances in communications and things like that that creates this sort of like city dwelling office worker population that hadn't existed at all before. So you end up needing to serve their needs, sell them stuff. They make more money than people who work in factories, and they have more leisure time. So all of these products and services that are created during the Industrial Revolution sort of get funneled toward them. But this group of people needs to know how to think about itself, needs to know why they should buy things, why they should patronize these stores. There was a lot during this era, there was a lot of suspicion of industrial businesses and large corporations, because it was clear to everybody that they were mistreating factory workers. This was the era of the Pinkertons and of strike breaking. So You had a lot of people who were sort of like had more money and had more leisure time, but needed to be convinced that these big corporate stores were looking out for them. So basically what those stores did is they gave people who were making more money and had more leisure time sort of an opportunity to play at being rich and play at sort of having that life of leisure and the life of luxuries that wealthy people had during the era. And they sort of the store provided that, not just by providing those products, but by providing a class of people that would serve, you know, essentially this new middle class that they would get to feel like they could order around, that they would be taken care of, that they would be treated like guests. And most retail businesses still refer to their customers as guests. And in order to sort of gain the trust of these people that had this money to spend all of a sudden, not only did they do that, but they became the department stores sort of became area centers of civic life. They gave to charities, they threw parades, many of which still exist, like the Macy's Day Parade in New York. They had restaurants, they hosted performances, they did all of these things to sort of assure the new middle class that corporate America could be trusted and corporate America could be relied upon to take care of them. And corporate America would make them feel special and wanted and served. And in order to create that feeling, you need a lot of service workers, which is where this divide began.
Talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about a column on consumer culture in the United States, why service workers are often treated badly by the pandemic made things worse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Chris now in Appleton. Chris, hi.
Hello. I work in retail. I have had some experience working in retail for several years, ranging from doing inventory service to I once did a Christmas season at Macy's. Ooh. And where I'm currently at right now, which I can't mention. But we were beginning of the pandemic, we saw our customer base go from basically near bad to worse to downright ugly. And a lot of it was due to situations that were beyond our control. First, we were having to deal with the mask issue. Then it was we were running out of supplies. Then it was trying to order these supplies and finding they were back ordered. And right now we're dealing with back to school, where we're trying to do pretty much everything that we do and then some, while still trying to do the other stuff that we were dealing with as a result of pandemic.
Wow. Chris, thank you so much for sharing that. Amanda, Chris, not alone, I'm guessing, in the retail world.
No, not at all. I think that his terrible experience is sort of typical, unfortunately, for what a lot of retail workers and service workers have experienced during the pandemic. The mask mandates are a big flashpoint for a segment of the population, and people who are feeling sort of like existentially frustrated over having to play by rules that they don't believe in or that they wouldn't choose for themselves. When they go to the grocery store, suddenly they have someone who they feel is A, inferior to them, and B, should not be telling them what to do, to then enact that frustration on in some respects. So finally, people who have this pent up frustration have a person that they feel entitled to express it toward or upon. And then you get like there have been stock issues across all kinds of retail businesses. So things are sold out. Servers at restaurants are understaffed because nobody wants to work in these conditions. And people are finding other jobs. So things come out slow at restaurants, and you just get all these sort of like points at which there's like a little bit of friction where things don't go exactly how somebody might think they should. And it's just like an entire pandemic's worth of frustration and anger and rage then gets pointed toward, somebody serving you at a restaurant or somebody checking you out at a store.
We're picking up our talk now with Amanda Mull, staff writer for The Atlantic, looking at the rise of consumer culture in America and the stress facing service workers in normal times, maybe even worse, during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, maybe your experiences working in the service sector. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go back to your calls now. Taryn is with us in Toma. Taryn, hello.
Hi. I was wondering if we were going to talk about the little salary revolution that a lot of places are having. Either customer service representatives believe they're not getting paid enough already, or there are payment differences between newbies and veterans. For example, I'm an assistant manager at my place, and I've worked there for more than 4 years now. I'm making $12 an hour, but newcomers are making $16 an hour, and that's at the lowest rank. And even though I asked for a raise, they denied me. So I'm wondering if we're going to talk about that big salary problem.
And Taryn, is this $16 wage because they're having trouble bringing new people in?
Most likely, yes.
And are they going to lose you if it doesn't change?
Most likely, yes.
Taryn, thank you so much for sharing that. Amanda, your thoughts on compensation levels for the service workers like Taryn that you've been writing about?
Well, I think people in Taryn's positions have been grossly underpaid for a very, very long time. I think that we've seen during the pandemic that much of our society does not work without service workers, and that they deserve to be compensated accordingly with all that they put up with. And I think that this situation that we're in, where companies are paying more in order to bring in workers, and a lot of companies aren't able to hire everyone they can, if they're going to do like what Taryn's company is doing and not give raises to their existing employees, there's no incentive for people to stay at those jobs. There are other companies hiring in this for those same skills and for that same experience that are going to pay more. So I think that what we're seeing right now, combined with the sort of the campaign for a $15 minimum wage for service workers and for anybody, is sort of a resetting of our understanding of how much these jobs deserve to be paid and how much this labor is worth. So companies that aren't willing to give raises to their existing loyal employees should expect them to go elsewhere.
Taryn, thanks for the call. John joins us next in Madison. John, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've worked in the service industry for about 10 years. And I saw this thing where service industry workers, when they're on their off time, would treat other service industry workers much better than people who weren't in the service industry. Grad and I probably have a smaller sample size to test with. I was wondering if your guest could speak to that. And also, what is your guest's thoughts on unionization?
John, thanks for the call. Amanda, I've heard the phrase, everybody should work retail at least once in their lives, or everyone should work at a restaurant at least once in their lives. John thinks that might help people treat each other better. What do you think? And he also mentioned unionization.
Well, I would say I'm extremely pro-unionization. I helped organize the Atlantic Staff Union this year, organizing it was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. So I think that there's going to be a lot of people in a lot of different industries, including service industry, looking at their options there, because being part of a union unlocks a lot of employment protections for you that just don't exist if you're outside of a union. I think that, a lot of people are going to be looking at that, and a lot of people should be. I think also on the issue of service industry workers treating each other better than customers outside of the service industry treat them, I think that that is a really common thing. And I think that it's to be expected, because a lot of consumer identity that we've been talking about here, that these department store barons invented 100 years ago, is built on the premise that you are better than the person who is serving you at a restaurant or helping you at a store, that you deserve to exert power over that person. If you work in the service industry, if you have recently, then you know that you're not better than the person who's helping you. You know that that is another person with the exact same value as anybody else. And I think that you're more inclined to be empathetic about what that person might be dealing with that day, the types of treatment they get from customers, things like that. So the bad behavior is built on a sense of superiority. And, that's harder to have when you've had those same experiences.
Thanks for that call, John. We're talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic, looking at why we mistreat service workers. Back to your calls. JC is with us in Madison. JC, hi.
Hi there.
What'd you want?
I want to talk about a good experience with I own a small retail store, and our customers really like what we sell, and they are excited and they're happy that we were able to stay open during the pandemic, even though it was for curbside delivery only. One thing that I really want to impress upon people is that we serve the customer, and we are supposed to serve the customer, but they serve us too, and they are our livelihood. And so I think they understand that. But the other thing is, when the president initiated this $15 an hour for all people to work as a minimum wage, it really hurt us as a small business. And because our income is not based on that, and it doesn't allow people to have the flexibility. We lost 8 of our employees, and we're having trouble hiring anybody back because people don't want to get more than the $15 an hour, and we can't afford it.
JC, thanks a lot for the call. Amanda, you focused on larger retail mostly in your piece. Any thoughts on smaller business owners like JC?
Well, I'm a little bit confused because there's no right. Law saying that $15 is the minimum wage in this country. It's whatever the Wisconsin state government says it is in Wisconsin right now. So I'm not exactly sure what she's asking about, but I think that this might be a bone to pick with the enhanced unemployment. And I would say that enhanced unemployment isn't to blame for this. If you look at the numbers, even in states that have ended their enhanced unemployment participation with the U.S. government, you really don't get a lot more people going back to work. And you have to look a little bit further for why that is. And it's because childcare is not as available. It's because in these types of industries, schedules aren't as reliable. So if you don't have childcare available all the time and you don't have a reliable schedule, then you're going to be in a position where it's going to take more money for you to go back to work to make that math work out. So you've got people who, if they still have access to any kind of unemployment, just because they can't pay for childcare and they can't guarantee that they'll have childcare, they end up staying home. And retail and service workers are predominantly younger people. So they're people who might have young kids around, who are far more likely to have young kids around. So there's a lot of sort of like, issues that you then deal with in getting people back to work, because not all of the services that they need in order to take jobs are back yet.
Amanda, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Amanda Mull from The Atlantic. She writes a column on consumerism called Material World. We talked to her today about why she says American consumers have been trained for years to be bad customers in many ways and often to mistreat service workers, and why things have even gotten worse during the pandemic. Still time for you to share your own experiences as a service worker, maybe, on the Ideas Network Facebook page.